paragraph reference for the objective. Is it 113 paragraphs?
Do the writing over the page one. Just a few housekeeping things for you, and apologies, we're running a little bit late. Should there be an emergency, your emergencies are here, and there's another one up there, which is the way you came in, and obviously we'll just clear out the way if that needs to happen. That, I think, is everything, and we're about to start, unless anyone has anything that needs doing.
Please be seated.
It's my great pleasure this morning to stand and welcome the Environment Court here to Otakau, to Waterpoti, at the shelter of our mountains, to beside the harbour, Otakau, that flows in and out. And here in this museum, it's quite fitting, I think, that we're holding the hearing here, which houses huge amount of our time, but of course many time for the whole. So we wish you well in the hearing, and welcome twice, thrice. We know the importance of your work for us all and for our environment here in Otago. So ngā mihi kia koutou kia kaha, te mana manui, te roko tēnā te rā mahi. koutou katoa huri no te pare, ka tēnā koutou, i e rā roku, tētahi ki tētahi, ngā mihi atu te koutou katoa. So I also greet everyone who's still here today, representing whoever you're representing, and bid you well in the proceedings that are coming forward. Kawe wariwari chia, o rātou kua hinga atu, rātou kua kitua tārai, o te whānau tipa, i takotuana i roku tamarai, o Moedaki, me te whānau tarāta, takotumai i roku tamarai, ki Pokaparaki. Ngā mihi atu ki a rātou, me koutou kōma ati o tēnei wā, o wiki te tau o tēnei tau. Haere, moi moi, oki oki moi. So, also, it's appropriate in here in this museum to acknowledge those who have gone before us, and I've just mentioned that we do have several Māori on our Māori and Otago at the moment. So, we bid them farewell. Huri no ki te kaupapa, pai teka tēnei kaupapa, e pai te wharahi teka mō tātou nei tāo tātou. So turn to the kaupapa, for it to get to the stage, and we look forward to it. Proceedings and how it rolls out. Andy, go to the kaupapa.
Manu tia, manu tia, ki te koko te ata tātou, mere e kātou mai i te umi, e tau e koia. Koia, koia, ko tārariki ki mai maui, e hārai me pitu me te aru.
Thank you. This is the Otago Regional Council proposed Plan Change 7.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hou, e whā, nā mai, haru mai. Ko kai whakawā Jane Borthwick a hou. Ka tū ahi a hou ki rotu i tēne rupu. Ko just Bruce Stephen. Te kai whakawā. Rātum ko David Bunting. Te kai homiana. Ko Catherine Edmonds. Te kai homiana. Nāmihi ke te kōti, nāmihi ke te kōti tāra. Good morning to you all, and I add my greetings to you, sir, Mr. Allison, as well. So good morning to everybody who is here, to those who are from here, and those who have travelled far away to be here. I understand that many of you will have been travelling from around the region. So good morning to you all. It's the process or practice of this court to do a call over, just to see who is in the house, so to speak, then to go on to talk about some housekeeping that we may need to do, and to take any last requests or any last directions before we move to Mr. Moore, who's going to be presenting the opening submissions for the Regional Council. So, we'll start with the call over, Mr. Moore and Ms. Nalhoff for Otago Regional Council. Good morning.
Kia ora, Your Honour. Winchester for Ngā Runanga, and I'll be joined later this morning by Ms. Lennon.
Good morning.
Please the court, my name's Paige. I am here for the Otago Water Resources User Group with Missouri.
And the territorial authorities. In addition, are you representing any individual submitters apart from the user group in and of its own right?
Well, We may do as the hearing progresses, particularly when you sit in Cromwell. Mm-hmm. There are a number of permit holders who have become parties in their own right who are also members of ORAC. And so we may well enter appearances for some of them who will get here. But as of this morning, no, I'm just entering appearance for ORAC.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honour. Ms. Dixon for the Minister for the Environment.
Good morning, Ms. Dixon. Ms. Williams.
Tēnā korua e ngā kaipakoa, tēnā korua e ngā kaikamihana. Ko Ms. Williams of what we do to know, Tēnā of Conservation.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honour. I'm Marie Baker Galloway for Otago Fish and Game Council.
Good morning.
Please report, Marie, known acting for Strathclyde Water Limited, MacArthur Ridge Vineyards Limited, and the Nile Council of the Statesman.
Good morning, Mr. Reid.
I'm pleased to call Councillor St. Anderson, David Forrest Manager.
Good morning.
I'm pleased to call. My name is Welsh. I'm here on behalf of Trust Valley.
Good morning. I think that's all the lawyers in the House. Are there any other parties who wish to have enter a formal appearance before we move off until the opening submission? All right. Okay. So, before that, I did say housekeeping. So, as you know, we had the ability to be able to run an audio-visual hearing, and that was in anticipation that we may be moving in and out of regional lockdowns. As it happens, we're not in, not in a lockdown this week, but that could change. So, what we thought we would do is continue to load the visual files. They'll be available now at the end of the day. We had thought they would be available sooner, but it will be the end of the day because they're very large files to put together in a format that can be uplifted into where we're lodging them within the court system. And that is together with the audio file as well. At this stage, we're anticipating uplifting at the end of the day, but we can do it on a more frequent basis. We can do it four times per day. I think we can do it four times per day. We just need to check that through with Shipley's. Transcripts, we will have a transcript available, and we have requested a 48-hour turnaround. I know that's not as quick as the regional and the district councils are able to produce, but our transcription service, which is an excellent service, is nevertheless a single service producing transcripts for the entire court system. So 48-hour turnaround is a very quick turnaround for them. We'll be uplifting, it'll have to be a day-by-day transcript for obvious reasons. I'm told this morning that we could also project documents onto the screen. Now, that is something that we can do in the courtroom. Obviously, no courtrooms available for us for the scale of hearing and the length of time that we need. I wasn't aware of that, but that could be really useful rather than pulling in and out large files with documents on them. So we haven't got parties ready to present in that way, and I think we're still working through with our service provider, Shipley's, as to how that can be made to work. It won't be made to work this morning. There are now that we are aware of the service, we are working through issues at our end in terms of what is the best way to get the documents to us. It's a Shipley's system, so it's not, it probably is that the documents will have to come to us on a stick, thumbnail drive. Hopefully everybody will be familiar with that, but we need to work through this morning what are the technological requirements around that. But that would certainly speed things up if there is to be cross-examination or references made to any document on the common bundle or any attachment to a brief of evidence. So stick with us, and we're probably going to be making more announcements about that later, after lunchtime. Should also introduce the full team. We have our friend of Submitter, Jane White, who's sitting in the back room of the court, back of the court, and Jane remains available to any party, should any party have any questions about practice and process. And Jane's going to be here over the next day or so. If there's no particular questions coming to Jane, then she'll return home to Christchurch, but will be available again in Cromwell, because it can be a really daunting process to understand
what is going on at a court does vary from what goes on at a regional and district council level hearing. So Jane is here, and we also have with us Glenn Cooper and Rebecca Johnson, who are sitting behind you, and they are going to be key people in this hearing in terms of the smooth and efficient running of this hearing, whether we're working to time, whether we're going quicker than what is anticipated. I imagine things will be slow to start with, but will rapidly pick up, which means that the hearing schedule will probably also change. That would be the normal course with any hearing. And Kathy Harlow, as you know, my hearing manager, is here and is also available to assist any party, together with Laura G, who's sitting beside her, also available to assist any party. So we put in a lot of resources because it's an unusual process. In fact, it's the first time that we've had plan changes called in by a government minister for determination by a court. So we've put in a lot of people that you can talk to should you have any questions about our practice, about our procedure. And if anyone can't answer any questions, then the normal process is just for that to be referred to me, and if I can assist, I will. So that's us. Are there any last requests for directions before we start with these submissions? No? Oh, no, Miss Baker Galloway, you have something on your mind.
A question of clarification about attendances through the duration of the hearing. In your last minute, you said, paragraph 7, the court does not expect parties to attend the whole hearing, and you don't need to seek leave to do that. So I'm going to take advantage of that chair's offer, but I just wanted to double-check that that was appropriate.
I think that's appropriate. I mean, this isn't a contest in as between the parties, if you like, as the normal contest that we would receive in the Environment Court on appeal. If there's a contest, it's as between yourself and this proposed plan change, and so yourself and the client that Mr. Moore represents. So no party needs to be here, save to run their own case, and that's an advantage that you are here when running your own case, or cross-examining if you've given notice to the court that you wish to cross-examine. But otherwise, you don't have to ask our leave.
Thank you. And acknowledging that the schedule will change from time to time, to the extent that it doesn't, parties, you know, this includes witnesses and parties as well, can sort of anticipate that they know when they're going to turn up with sufficient
we'll
notice.
We'll be communicating with you in a timely fashion. If not at lunchtime, it will be by the end of the end of the day. What we've requested, as inconvenient as it is that if you know that your witness has been scheduled for the morning, sometime in the morning, that they are available first thing in the morning and equally in the afternoon, first thing in the afternoon. So we anticipate there'll be some amount of waiting around, but that can't be managed any better than I think what we're doing. And if there is a likelihood of the schedule changing such that witnesses are being brought forward a day early or so, probably Mr. Cooper, Glenn Cooper, will be in contact with you to see whether or not that actually can be arranged. It might not be able to be accommodated due to other commitments. We'll see, but as I said, likely that we're going to start a slow hearing, but it'll pick up, and I imagine it's going to go pretty quick from next week onwards. I would say these things always take a while to bed down, and then they pick up.
Yeah. Thank you, ma'am.
All right, thank you. Any other questions before we start the hearing formally? No other questions. All right. So, Mr. Moore, we are in your hands.
Thank you, Your Honour. I'll get prepared some written submissions and I'll just hand those up.
Council is at a critical stage in its freshwater planning. The current freshwater planning framework in Otago is acknowledged as no longer being fit for purpose. It is a product of its time, being prepared prior to the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management 2020. A new NPSFM compliant framework is required, and the Council is committed to having that new framework in place by 31 December 2023. The Council is due to notify a new regional policy statement in June 2021. This will include as objectives the long-term visions for freshwater in the Otago region. These long-term visions are currently being developed through engagement with communities and tangata whenua. They will express the aspirations of communities and tangata whenua for each FMU or part FMU. This will provide the foundation for freshwater management in the new land and water regional plan and set the basis for identifying values, setting environmental outcomes and environmental flows and levels as required by the NPSFM. The Council has committed to notifying a new land and water regional plan by 31 December 2023. The Council science team has created a number of dedicated work streams and has focused on building capacity in order to meet this deadline. In the meantime, 312 deemed permits and approximately 235 other water permits, representing a significant proportion of primary allocation in Otago, are due to expire. Without an intervening planning response, those permits will be renewed within a pre-NPSFM planning framework, and where the expectation on the part of applicants is that a permit will be granted for a long duration. The critical issue for the Council is that the new LWRP, developed through a community-driven national objectives framework process, is not frustrated by the grant of long-term water permits in the interim. Plan Change 7 is the intervening planning response required to ensure that the outcomes of the community-driven NOF process can be effectively implemented within an appropriate timeframe. I now turn to the purpose of Plan Change 7. The purpose of Plan Change 7 is to allow for an efficient and timely transition to a new land and freshwater management regime that gives full effect to the NPSFM. It establishes an interim planning framework to facilitate the cost-effective and efficient assessment of resource consent applications for the replacement of deemed permits and for the take and use of freshwater. The need for an interim framework stems from the following interlinked issues. First, historically high levels of water taking in parts of the region and an allocation framework in the operative regional plan water that does not prioritise first the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems. Inadequacy of other aspects of the planning framework in the operative water plan in terms of giving effect to the objectives and policies of the NPSFM 2020. An operative planning framework that has created challenges for Ngāi Tahu ki Murihiku, including in relation to notification decisions and the extent to which consideration of kaitahu rights, interests and values has been able to influence decision making. A lack of understanding about the current state of Otago's pattern of land use and freshwater resources and the effect of water takes on these resources when viewed through the lens of the new NPSFM. Uncertainty around the planning framework, including environmental outcomes and limits that will be established in accordance with the NPSFM and the new freshwater planning framework that is due to be notified by 31 December 2023. The pending expiry of a large number of water permits and growing demand for water prior to the new freshwater planning framework becoming operative by 31 December 2025. These issues were highlighted in Professor Skelton's investigation of the Council's freshwater management and allocation functions and led to the Minister for the Environment making recommendations to the Council under Section 24 capital A of the Act to prepare a plan change by 31 March 2020 that will provide an adequate interim planning and consenting framework to manage freshwater up until the time the new discharge and allocation limits are set, in line with the requirements of the NPSFM. The Minister encouraged consideration of a narrow plan change that provides for the relatively low cost and fast issuing of new consents on a short-term basis as an interim measure until sustainable allocation rules are in place, and noted that those consents could, for example, be for a maximum term of 5 years or until the new LWP becomes operative, whichever comes first. It was also suggested that it may be beneficial to include these provisions in a standalone plan change. In response to the Minister's recommendations, the Council agreed to prepare and notify by 31 March 2020 the Water Permits Plan Change, that is Plan Change 7. PC 7 was notified on the 18th of March 2020 and then re-notified by the EPA on the 6th of July 2020 after the Minister called PC 7 in, having considered it to be part of a proposal of national significance and directed that it be referred to the Environment Court for decision. The objective of PC 7 as recommended to be amended by Mr. De Pelsmaker has been set out in my paragraph 11. To implement this objective, Plan Change 7 as notified proposed a two-tiered consenting pathway by which applicants can apply for a resource consent to replace an existing deemed permit or water permit that expires before 31 December 2025, either as a controlled activity or where they cannot meet the controlled activity conditions as a non-complying activity. At its core, the controlled activity pathway is intended to allow existing activities to continue for a short period, being 6 years, without exacerbating the effects on the environment until the new NPSFM compliant planning framework is in place. Long-term duration consents are disincentivised through strong policy direction to only grant resource consents for 6 years or 15 years in limited circumstances, recognising that there may be true exceptions whereby a six-year permit would be inappropriate. The framework seeks to enable the transition to long-term sustainable management of freshwater by reducing the risk of further environmental degradation through avoiding the reallocation of unused paper allocation, limiting the quantity of water allocated in resource consents issued in replacement of existing water permits to the quantity of water that has been used in the past, the requirement to carry over minimum flow, residual flow, or take cessation conditions on existing consents as consent conditions on any consents that replace existing water permits, and discouraging further investment in irrigation expansion until a new NPSFM compliant planning framework is in place. PC 7 does not give full effect to the NPSFM. It is a holding measure that allows existing activities to continue for a short period of time without increasing the effects on the environment until the new NPSFM compliant land and water plan is in place. This will enable those activities to be reassessed under the new NPSFM compliant framework rather than long-term decisions being made under the current water plan, which is acknowledged as not being fit for purpose and not giving effect to the NPSFM. It is also acknowledged that there are significant challenges associated with promulgating a plan change that has the effect of rolling over existing resource allocation for a short period of time. However, the alternative of not acting now may well result in a situation where any new land and water plan that gives full effect to the NPSFM is unable to be implemented in a timely manner. When weighing those risks, it is submitted that PC 7 is the most appropriate option at this point in time. In the remainder of these submissions, I address first the legal framework and the key legal tests relating to Plan Change 7. I then provide an overview of the key issues for determination at this hearing in light of the submissions and evidence and the Council's position in relation to those issues. And finally, I touch on the evidence to be called by the Council. So starting now with the legal framework and the key legal tests. Plan Change 7 has been prepared in response to the Minister's recommendations and in accordance with the RMA statutory framework as it applies to a regional plan change. On the 8th of April 2020, following notification of PC7 by the Council, the Minister for the Environment exercised his powers under Section 142(2)(b) of the Act and called in PC7, having considered it to be part of a proposal of national significance, and directed that it be referred to the Environment Court for decision. The relevant tests for the Court when considering this plan change are set out in Section 149(U)(1). The Environment Court must apply Clause 10(1)-3 of Schedule 1 as if it were a local authority, and it may exercise the powers under Section 293, and it must apply Section 66-70, 77A and 77D as if it were a regional council. In addition, the Court must have regard to the Minister's reasons for making a direction in relation to PC7 and consider any information provided to it by the EPA under Section 149G. Part 11 of the RMA applies to proceedings under Section 149U, except if inconsistent with any provisions of the section. So I now touch on the Minister's reasons for referring PC7 to the Environment Court. In accordance with Section 149U1A, the Court must have regard to the Minister's reasons for making the direction. Have regard to requires the decision maker to give genuine attention and thought to the matter. In the direction, the Minister stated that PC7 is a proposal of national significance for the reasons that I've set out in paragraph 26. The direction states that calling in PC7 as part of a proposal of national significance and referring it to the Environment Court for decision would first assist the Council by allowing its staff to focus on developing the proposed land and water regional plan and avoid potential delays associated with the Schedule 1 process of the RMA that could complicate the development of a new land and water regional plan. Where a matter has been called in and referred to the Environment Court for decision, obligations are placed on the EPA to provide certain information to the Environment Court. In accordance with the Act, the EPA has provided to the Environment Court the notified version of Plan Change 7, all information received by the EPA that relates to PC7, including the Section 32 report, the submissions received by the Council and the EPA on Plan Change 7, and a report prepared by the Council on the key issues in relation to PC7. The relevant legal requirements under Section 66-70 and 77A and 77D are set out in Appendix 1 for the Court's reference. I do not propose to take the Court through each of these requirements, but rather focus on the key tests at issue, including the requirement to give effect to the NPSFM, the National Policy Statement for Renewable Electricity Generation 2011, and the National Policy Statement for Urban Development 2020. I will also address the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. I then go on to address the relevance of the Minister's recommendation and the Skelton Report to the Court's consideration and determination of this plan change. I deal first with the NPSFM and its application. PC7 was notified publicly by the Council on 18 March 2020, re-notified by the EPA on 6 July 2020, and submissions were lodged when the NPSFM 2014 as amended 2017 was in force. On the 5th of August 2020, the Government gazetted a number of documents as part of its Action for Healthy Waterways package, including the NPSFM 2020, which came into force on the 3rd of September 2020 and replaced the NPSFM 2014. Clause 4.1 of the NPSFM 2020 provides that every local authority must give effect to this national policy statement as soon as reasonably practicable. In accordance with Section 80 capital A of the Act, the Council must notify a freshwater planning instrument where that instrument has the purpose of giving effect to the NPSFM 2020 by 31 December 2024. It is submitted that PC7 does not need to give full effect to the NPSFM 2020. Rather, the Council must give effect to the NPSFM 2020 as soon as is reasonably practicable. The situation before this Court with respect to the introduction of the NPSFM 2020 mid-process is not new and has occurred before with previous iterations of the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management. In Ngāti Kahununu and Hawke's Bay Regional Council, the Environment Court held that the applicable National Policy Statement in that case was the NPS 2014, which came into force following the Council's decision on proposed Change 5 to the Hawke's Bay Regional Council Regional Resource Management Plan, but prior to the Environment Court hearing appeal on the 3rd and 4th of December 2014. Similarly, in Hawke's Bay and Eastern Fish and Game Council and the Hawke's Bay Regional Council, the High Court considered the question of which freshwater policy statement ought to be given effect to following an appeal and the referral of a provision back to the decision maker for reconsideration, in this case a Board of Inquiry. The Court acknowledged that the effect of its direction for reconsideration meant that the Board of Inquiry would have given effect to the NPSFM 2011 in relation to most of the plan change and to the NPSFM 2014 in relation to the specific issue referred back to it. By contrast, in Horticulture New Zealand and the Manawatū Whanganui Regional Council, the High Court held that on appeal, the Environment Court was not obliged to give effect to the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management 2011. So in short, two contrasting approaches with respect to the High Court, which I will now go on to address in terms of which ought to be preferred by this court.
It's funny because my margin note reads, are these cases actually contrasting? I don't know. I haven't read them. I don't know. It might actually turn on. It may be fact specific. So anyway, I'll let you continue. I take it you've got a bundle of cases.
Where do we get to with that? We have an electronic bundle given the size of it, and yeah, we can make that available. And if there are some particular cases, we could have copies of those printed.
Oh, just those two.
These two
just
might.
Just those two of particular notice, of interest. But anyway,
yes.
You tell me where you're going to go.
Very good. So in relation to the Environment Court's rationale for not considering the evidence it had before it on the relevance of the new NPS, which was upheld by the High Court on appeal, was that the new NPS only came into force long after the POP, was well advanced. So this is the second of those High Court decisions. Further, Justice Koshy emphasised the limited jurisdiction of the Environment Court and the fact that it does not sit in an executive plan-making and plan-changing role. In my submission, the approach taken by the High Court in the first of the two High Court cases is preferable and ought to be followed here. The High Court's approach in that case best reflects the requirements of Section 67(3)(a) of the RMA, but is also more consistent with the purpose of the Act being to promote the sustainable management of natural and physical resources. And further, in contrast to the second High Court decision, this PC7 process is far less advanced than that process where it had been on appeal and then referred back, this hearing being the first hearing of submissions on this plan change. And I would say, by contrast here, the court is sitting in an executive plan-making role with respect to Plan Change 7, there having been no other decisions made on submissions to date. And so accordingly, to the extent that there is scope to do so, this court should strive to give effect to the NPSFM 2020. In saying that, it is important to acknowledge that the NPSFM 2020 is in many respects a significant departure from previous iterations of the NPS, particularly in respect of the manner by which the document is to be implemented. However, the extent to which it is reasonably practicable for PC7 to give effect to the NPSFM 2020 is confined by both the limited scope and subject matter of PC7 and the scope in submissions. Council accepts that unless and until certain implementation steps have been followed, the NPSFM cannot be fully given effect to. Those implementation steps are set out in Part 3 of the NPSFM and involve comprehensive procedural requirements for regional councils when making decisions on how to give effect to that document. Many of these processes require substantial tangata whenua and community engagement by regional councils. Given the confines of Plan Change 7 and its process, the implementation steps in Part 3 of the NPSFM are not directly relevant to the court. A key aspect of the NPSFM 2020 and a departure from the previous iterations is the hierarchy of obligations set out in Objective 1 and required by Policy 1. One of the key changes is the further elevation and articulation of the concept of tamana or tawai. Tamana or tawai has the meaning set out in Clause 1.3 and is described as a fundamental concept encompassing six principles along with the hierarchy of obligations. The six key principles are first, mana whakahaere, kaichiakitanga, mana kitanga, governance, stewardship, and care and respect. The hierarchy of obligations is enshrined in the only objective in the NPSFM 2020, which I've set out in paragraph 46. In addition to the articulation of tamana or tawai in Clause 1.3 and the objective, the Council must engage with communities and tangata whenua to determine how tamana or tawai applies to water bodies and freshwater ecosystems in the region. Accordingly, while it is possible to initiate action intended to give effect to the NPSFM, It is submitted that it is not possible to fully give effect to the true intent of that document until such time as the local approach to giving effect to mana or to wai, as required by Clause 3.4, has been determined. This necessarily has a bearing on the extent to which PC7 can give effect to the MPSFM, also acknowledging the scope constraints for these processes. There are 15 policies in the MPSFM, and it is submitted that PC7 is a step towards giving effect to the following policies, insofar as they are relevant. First, policy one, freshwater is managed in a way that gives effect to Te Mana or Te Wai, noting the meaning given in clause 1.3. Policy three, freshwater is managed in an integrated way that considers the effects of the use and development of land on a whole of catchment basis, including the effects on receiving environments. Policy seven, the loss of river extent and values is avoided to the extent practicable. Policy 9, the habitats of indigenous freshwater species are protected. Policy 10, the habitat of trout and salmon is protected insofar as this is consistent with Policy 9. And Policy 11, freshwater is allocated and used efficiently. All existing over-allocation is phased out and future over-allocation is avoided. Now, in relation to Policy 11, I would note that Plan Change 7 goes some way to implementing that policy, but it doesn't go so far as phasing out all existing over-allocation, given the process that needs to be followed to determine the appropriate level of allocation available for the freshwater resources, and that process will follow as the implementation steps take place with respect to the new land and water regional plan. Plan Change 7 is intended to provide an interim regulatory framework for the assessment of applications to renew deemed permits expiring in 2021 and any other water permits expiring prior to 31 December 2025, the date by which the new LWRP, which has been prepared to give effect to the MPSFM and scheduled to be notified by 31 December 2023, is expected to be operative. If I just interpolate there, it may appear that a two-year period is a relatively short period between notification and a plan becoming operative, but that's a reflection of the new Freshwater Planning Commission process as opposed to the current two-step process. It's anticipated that the time between notification and a plan being operative will be much shorter.
So this plan will be referred to the Commission?
Correct.
Okay.
The interim framework is important to ensure that the Council can implement the NPSFM compliant provisions of its new LWRP in a timely manner without being constrained by the allocation and taking of water under numerous water permits with long-term durations. Ultimately, a decision maker, in this case the Court, is required to give effect to the NPSFM 2020 to the extent that there is scope within submissions, noting the constraints of the confined nature of PC7 and the subject matter therein. As an interim framework, PC7 is not designed to give full effect to the NPSFM. Rather, it seeks to ensure that the outcomes of the NOF process can be effectively implemented through the new RPS and LWRP. Turn now to the NPS for renewable electricity generation. PC7 must also give effect to that policy statement to the extent that it is relevant. This national policy statement sets out the objective and the policies for renewable electricity generation under the Act, and I'll set out a relevant part from the preamble. The relevance of that preamble was considered by the Court in Carterholt Harvey and Waikato Regional Council. I've set out the relevant passage there. Thank you. And the objective from that NPS is set out at paragraph 54. The NPSREG requires, amongst other matters, first, for decision makers shall recognise and provide for the national significance of renewable electricity generation activities, including the national, regional and local benefits relevant to renewable electricity generation activities, and that's policy A. Decision makers shall have particular regard to the maintenance of the generation output of existing renewable electricity generation activities, can require protection of the assets, operational capacity and continued availability of the renewable energy resource, that's policy B, and that regional policy statements and regional and district plans shall include objectives, policies and methods, including rules within plans, to provide for the development, operation, maintenance and upgrading of new and existing hydroelectricity generation activities to the extent applicable to the region or district, set out in policy E2. The requirement for decision makers to have particular regard to the above matters can be contrasted with the requirements in policy A, that decision makers shall recognise and provide for the national significance of renewable electricity generation activities, and policy D, that decision makers shall, to the extent reasonably possible, manage activities to avoid reverse sensitivity effects on consented and on existing renewable electricity generation activities. It is relevant to note that the NPSREG itself recognises the tension that can sometimes exist between renewable electricity generation and matters of national importance, as set out in Section 6, and other matters in Section 7 of the Act. Given the wording of the NPSREG, particularly the terms to recognise, provide for and have particular regard to, it is considered that the NPSREG, to which effect must be given, is not particularly prescriptive in managing this tension. Rather, the NPSREG is worded at a higher level of abstraction such that the Council has a greater degree of flexibility as to how it implements the NPSREG in its region than it would if the NPSREG was framed in a more specific and unqualified way. And I note there a passage from the implementation guide for that NPSREG. In terms of the application of those provisions in the context of trust power submission, I flag that I do address that in relation to one of the issues to be determined further on in my submissions. The third NPS to give effect to, insofar as it's relevant, is the NPS for urban development. The NPS UD came into force on the 20th of August 2020 after PC7 was notified. A key objective of the NPSUD is that New Zealand has well-functioning urban environments that enable all people and their communities to provide for their social, economic and cultural well-being and for their health and safety now and into the future. Part 4 of the NPSUD includes timeframes for implementation. Every Tier 1, 2 and 3 local authority must amend its regional policy statement or district plan to give effect to the provisions of the NPSUD as soon as practicable. There are also timeframes within which Tier 1 and 2 local authorities must comply with specific policies, including those relating to intensification, the development of a future development strategy, housing and business capacity assessment, and car parking. Notably, there is no requirement to amend a regional plan. In relation to the NPSUD requirement for councils to ensure that there is sufficient development capacity, it is noted that Schedule 10, capital A4 of Plan Change 7 only applies to the replacement of existing permits. If new permits are required to provide for growth, then these would be assessed under the rest of the water plan, but subject to policy 10A2.2 of PC7 requiring a consent duration of 6 years. It is submitted that a consent duration of 6 years would enable councils to meet their obligations under the NPSUD to ensure that there is adequate existing development infrastructure in the short term and would not impede their ability in the medium term to identify funding for infrastructure to support development of land identified in the long-term plan. And again, on this issue, I address in the key issues part of my submissions the relevance of this NPS to the submission lodged by the territorial authorities. I now deal with the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. Section 8 of the Act requires the Council to take into account the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi when exercising functions and powers under the Act in relation to managing the use, development and protection of natural and physical resources. In cases under other legislation, the courts have identified the following principles of the treaty. First, the two parties to the treaty entered into a partnership and therefore must act reasonably and honourably towards each other and in utmost good faith. The Crown must make informed decision, which will often require consultation. The Crown must not unreasonably impede its capacity to provide redress for proven grievances, and the Crown must actively protect Māori interests. The obligation to take into account is a requirement to weigh the principles of the treaty with all other matters being considered, and in coming to a decision, effect a balance between the principles and all other matters. However, the principles do not necessarily prevail over the other matters that local authorities must recognise and provide for, or have regard to, under the Act. Although the application of Section 8 is fact-specific, the courts have identified specific obligations for local authorities to enable active participation of Māori in dealing with resources of known or likely value to Māori, to engage with tangata whenua in good faith, to see mutual reciprocity and benefit where possible, to endeavour to protect resources of importance to Māori from adverse effects, and to take positive action to protect tangata whenua interests, which will at times oblige councils to initiate, facilitate and monitor consultation. A detailed analysis of the principles of the treaty and their application under Section 8 of the Act is set out in Appendix H of Mr De Pelsmaker's evidence in chief. How the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi have been taken into account in the development of Plan Change 7 is also set out in Mr De Pelsmaker's evidence in chief at his paragraphs 127 to 142. As set out in the evidence of Kaitahu Ki Otago, the ORC is now working in partnership with interested Papatipu Runanga to ensure that the new RPS and the new Land and Water Regional Plan appropriately address cultural rights and interests and values. In the absence of PC7, there is a very real risk that the outcomes of that partnership approach will be frustrated by the granting of long-term water permits. The granting of long-term consents would foreclose the ability to change the status quo in freshwater management in the catchments that are dominated by the demand or by the deemed permits for another generation. I move now to the relevance of the Minister's recommendations and the Skelton Report. Section 24, capital A of the Act provides the Minister with the power to investigate and make a recommendation on a local authority's exercise or performance of any of its functions, powers or duties under the Act. Pursuant to Section 24, capital A of the Act, the Minister engaged Professor Skelton to investigate whether the Council was adequately carrying out its functions in relation to freshwater management and the allocation of resources. Professor Skelton's report highlighted that one immediate issue facing the Council was developing a fit-for-purpose planning framework ahead of the expiry of deemed water permits on 1 October 2021. Professor Skelton considered that interim measures were necessary. He recommended, among other things, that the Minister initiate the necessary legislative process to change the date for expiry of the deemed permits in Section 413, subsection 3 of the Act from 1 October 2021 to 31 December 2025. This, in his view, would ensure that the replacement consent applications are assessed against a robust policy framework. The Minister considered that there was an urgent need to ensure that an interim framework is in place, but was not in favour of changing the RMA to extend the date for the expiry of the deemed permits. In response to Professor Skelton's recommendations, the Minister formally recommended under Section 24 capital A of the RMA that the Council, and I've set out the relevant passage there. And I've also set out at paragraph 72 in relation to his recommendation regarding an interim planning framework, that which the Minister also stated. The Minister's recommendations do not fall within the matters listed in Section 66(1) of the RMA that the Council must act in accordance with when considering a change to a regional plan, or the matters listed in Section 66(2) that the Court must have regard to when considering a change to a regional plan. Therefore, the Court is not required to consider the Minister's recommendations when considering Plan Change 7. However, despite not being a mandatory consideration, it is submitted that the Court can and should have regard to the Minister's recommendations when making a decision on Plan Change 7. It is well established that Section 66(2) of the Act does not create an exhaustive list of matters to be considered. The High Court has held that regard may be had to non-binding national policy documents as relevant background material, even if those documents do not have any status under the RMA. The Minister's recommendations are relevant background material to PC7 and should be given weight accordingly. The power of the Minister to investigate and provide recommendations to local authorities is an important component of the Minister's function to ensure that the RMA is properly implemented. Although recommendations made by the Minister under Section 24A of the Act are non-binding, they carry significant weight. Their importance is demonstrated by the consequences for a local authority if it does not act on a recommendation given by the Minister. In such circumstances, the Minister can appoint on such terms and conditions as the Minister thinks fit, one or more persons to exercise or perform all of or any of those functions or duties in place of the local authority, or direct a regional council to prepare a regional plan, change to a regional plan, or variation to a proposed regional plan to address the issue. The regional council must then act in accordance with this direction when preparing the relevant instrument. In the context of PC7, there is a close link between the Minister's investigation into the Council's performance of its freshwater management and resource allocation functions, the Minister's recommendations that the Council prepare an interim plan change to provide a framework for the processing of water permits until the LWRP becomes operative, and thirdly, the Minister's reasons for directing Plan Change 7 be called in and referred to the Environment Court for decision. Given the close link between the Minister's recommendations under Section 24 capital A and the Minister's reasons for making the direction, and the fact that the Court must have regard to those reasons when considering Plan Change 7, the Council submits that it is appropriate for the Court to place weight on the Skelton Report and the Minister's recommendations when considering Plan Change 7. I now turn to address the key issues for determination by this Court. There are two overarching issues for the Court's determination that have been raised in submissions and evidence filed on Plan Change 7. First, whether an interim planning framework is required, and secondly, if an interim planning framework is required, is PC7 the most appropriate option? These two overarching questions give rise to several key issues for the Court's determination. These issues are outlined below together with the Council's position in respect of each issue. I acknowledge that this is not an exhaustive list and that parties may frame the issues for determination differently. Some parties disagree with the basis for PC7, including the findings of the Skelton Report and the need for the Minister's recommendations, and consider that there is no need for an interim framework. Other parties agree with the basis for PC7, but consider that it does not go far enough either in relation to providing a simple and cost-effective consenting pathway for consents with a short duration, or that it does not go far enough in terms of environmental protection. So dealing with the question of whether an interim planning framework is required, in his evidence in chief, Mr. De Pelsmaker sets out five significant resource management issues that PC7 is seeking to address. Whilst each of these issues are addressed in evidence of the parties and are therefore addressed below as topics, it is the combination of these issues that has given rise to the need for the plan change. Therefore, it is not necessary for the court to make a determination on the presence or legitimacy or significance of each individual issue identified, but rather the question is whether there is an issue that needs to be resolved, and can the planning framework, the current planning framework, be relied upon to resolve that issue until a new land and water plan is notified. Put another way, is a change required to the status quo in the interim? So is there a resource management issue that needs to be resolved? The deficiencies in the current framework are discussed in the key issues report, the Skelton report, and in the evidence of Mr. De Pelsmaker, the evidence of Ms. Bartlett, the evidence of Ms. McIntyre, and in the evidence of a number of other expert witnesses. These deficiencies are well summarised in the evidence of Ms. McIntyre, where she considers that the water plan framework is inconsistent with the higher order direction for managing freshwater, or hampers the ability to give effect to that direction in the following ways. First, it does not recognise and address over allocation, and the approach to setting flow and allocation regimes is inadequate to protect in-stream values. Second, there is an apparent priority for consumptive use over in-stream values, with only narrow provisions in policies and rules to consider the effects of abstraction on natural and cultural values. Third, in consent decision-making, there is a strong focus on effects, as the abstraction point and inadequate, and inadequate consideration of effects, including cumulative effects, on the broader freshwater system. Hydrological and ecological information is often inadequate to assess such broader effects. Fourthly, policies incentivise increased use and increased dependence on water consumption. And fifthly, policy on consent duration gives inadequate direction and provides an expectation of long consent terms. There is an urgent need to develop a new freshwater planning framework to implement the new NPSFM. The outcomes of the NOF process will result in the setting of new environmental outcomes, the use of other or additional instruments, and setting of new standards and limits to address these outcomes. The replacement of 312 deemed permits and approximately 235 water permits expiring before that time will take place before the new framework is in place. There is a history and expectation of long-term consents being granted under the water plan. Given the deficiencies in the water plan, it is the Council's position that the replacement of permits under the existing water plan framework is likely to frustrate achieving the environmental outcomes that will be set in the new LWRP in a timely manner. Mr. Allison and Mr. Funga consider that it would also undermine the Rakateretaka and Kaichiakitaka of Kaitahu by foreclosing the ability to change the status quo of freshwater management in the catchments that are dominated by the deemed permits for another generation. The Council agrees with the position of Ngāru Nanga that it is important that long-term decisions on the deemed permits are made in the context of a new planning framework that gives effect to the NPSFM rather than the existing planning framework. This importance is also recognised in the submission and evidence on behalf of the Minister for the Environment. If there is a resource management issue that needs to be resolved, the next question is, can it be resolved under the existing framework? Several parties have raised the issue of whether an interim planning framework as provided by PC7 is necessary on the basis that the current planning framework under the water plan can be relied on. This is in part because parties consider that until a new LWRP is developed, consent applications under the water plan should be assessed directly against the NPSFM under section 104(1)(b), and any concerns about locking in decisions for the life of the LWRP can also be addressed by reviewing resource consents. In relation to the NPSFM, the Council must only have regard to any relevant provisions of the NPSFM when considering applications for resource consent under Section 104 of the Act. By contrast, PC7 must give effect to the NPSFM. The question of how much weight should be given to the objective and policies of the NPSFM will vary on an application-by-application basis. However, many of the policies in the NPSFM have more relevance to plan-making than resource consent applications, which will necessarily go to the weight that is ultimately placed on those policies when assessing a consent application.
Can you just pause there a second? Why do you say that in the your second sentence, paragraph 89? Starting with however. Just probably struggling with the sense, that's all.
So the submission that I make is that when you read the policies in the NPSFM, they are more directed to a council's plan-making function in terms of the language used within them, such that when considering, by contrast, resource consent applications on a case-by-case basis, they are more difficult to apply. The concern then is that given decision makers in the context of resource consent applications only have to have regard to those policies, it's somewhat easier to put them to one side or to perhaps apply less weight to those policies given the way in which they are expressed.
Only have regard to under Section 104?
Correct.
Yeah, 104, 1C. Yeah. And your question there is, well, if it's only to have regard to the provisions of the NPS on a case-by-case, you know, the resource consent application context, where that policy hasn't been articulated in a water plan or in the new land and water plan, what then? The council's what informs the outcomes, what is left to be determined on a case by case, or is uninformed by a regional plan of action, if you like, for the water plan.
Yes.
Unarticulated, save to the extent that the applicant may wish to articulate it on a resource consent application.
Yes, yeah. So the translation of those policies into regional plans, which are then applied in the consenting context. Where those policies are given their colour and their more direct meaning.
Okay.
So I think it picking up at paragraph 90. When assessing a consent application under the water plan, regard will need to be given to the hierarchy of obligations in Objective 1 of the NPSFM, and whether granting a particular application will prioritise first the health and wellbeing of the relevant water bodies and freshwater ecosystems, second, the health needs of people, and third, the ability of people and communities to provide for their social, economic and cultural well-being now and in the future. The objective of the NPSFM is not concerned with a single activity or water body, but rather with an integrated approach to freshwater management. The policies, in particular policies 1, 3, 5 and 11, also support an integrated approach to freshwater management, rather than dealing with those issues on a consent-by-consent approach, that for the reasons that we just expanded on. It's submitted that this is likely to be difficult to determine on a case-by-case basis, as in a consent-by-consent basis. In the absence of a NPSFM-compliant planning framework, it will be difficult to assess resource consent applications and how they might implement Te Mana or Te Wai and the hierarchy of obligations in the Otago context. Accordingly, it has submitted that reliance on an assessment of the objectives and policies of the MPSFM and resource consent applications under the water plan does not impact the necessity for the interim framework set out in PC7. Further, consent reviews under the Act are subject to a number of limitations. Section 128 of the Act enables the Council to initiate a review of consent conditions in specified circumstances, including for a purpose specified in a condition of consent, or where certain rules are made operative, i.e. rules relating to maximum or minimum levels of flows or rates of use of water, or minimum standards of water quality, and in the Council's opinion, it is appropriate to review the conditions of the permit in order to enable the levels, flows, rates or standards set by the rule to be met. However, the exercise of a review power under Section 128 does not allow the consent to be terminated, nor can amendments to consent conditions have the effect of preventing the activity for which the resource consent was granted in the first place. Ms. McIntyre agrees with Mr. De Pelsmaker that reliance on consent condition reviews will not be effective in making significant changes in freshwater management in catchments which, following the setting of limits, are found to be substantially over-allocated, or where significant changes to minimum flows or other measures are required to give effect to the NPSFM.
Just pause there a second. I'll have to reread Ms. McIntyre's evidence, but presumably she gives reasons for that at her paragraph 80.
Yes.
You're hoping.
Yes.
Not your witness. Okay. All right, just reminding you, we'll take a break at 11 o'clock, so perhaps if we finish at your last paragraph, make it 96.
Yes.
All right.
So a number of parties, so this is moving on to the balance of these submissions. If an interim planning framework is required, is Plan Change 7 the most appropriate option? So a number of parties support the need for and intent of Plan Change 7 in providing for a transitional framework until a new NPSFM compliant fit for purpose framework is developed. However, parties raise concerns about whether, as drafted, PC7 achieves that intent. Key issues raised are, is the control activity rule efficient and effective? Is the non-complying activity rule sufficiently robust? How should social and economic effects be weighed when considering Plan Change 7? Should there be a restriction on irrigation expansion? What should the data period be for calculating the rate of take and volume of water? How should the framework apply to hydroelectricity generation? How should the framework apply to community water supplies, and how should the framework apply to damming? Now, again, I reiterate, that's not an exhaustive list of the issues, but those having considered the evidence cover the majority of what I consider to be the significant issues. Other parties will continue to address or add issues to that list as this hearing develops.
And in relation to these issues, are you... is that intended to cover the schedule as well?
Yes, I pick up some on the way through. A number of these issues dovetail into the schedule itself, so that the schedule's relevant to probably half of the issues which are flagged on that list in terms of how the schedule actually deals with or accommodates particular activities.
Because one of the issues, am I right in thinking one of the issues for the schedule is... one of the issues as between parties on the schedule is how to clean up, if I could use it, put it that way, clean up the data on the schedule in relation to the schedule.
Yes, it is, and it's subparagraph E there in terms of the data period.
Yeah.
That could easily be brought into the data period and the quality of data.
Yeah.
That is a live issue.
It is, okay. All right, well, we'll take a break for... 15 minutes.
Which one of these is?
All rise.